Today's Tesho will be on case 46 in the Book of Serenity. Case 46 is entitled Deshan's Completion of Study. Introduction. The clear ground where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles deludes people. The clear sky without a fleck of cloud in the eight directions fools you. Even though this is using a wedge to remove a wedge, it doesn't prevent taking space and hanging it in space. A single mallet on the back of the brain particularly observe appropriate technique. Case, Great Master Wan Ming of Deshan said to the assembly, when you get to the ultimate end, you just find the Buddhas of all times have their mouths hung on the wall. There is still someone who laughs, ha ha. If you know this, your task of study is finished. Verse, gathering in, holding closed throat, wind polishes, clouds wipe. The waters are chill, the weather is autumn. Don't say brocade-colored fish lack rich taste. Fishing through the ocean waves, one hook of moon. Thank you all so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. I was talking to somebody last night, and the person had a really very wonderful sit. And this person has been practicing for a little while. The person said to me, oh, you know, I want to ask you a question since you've been doing this for 20-some years. And I said, actually, I've been doing this for 40 years. And I meant it right from the bottom of my heart. You know, I hope I live another 40 years just so I can do 40 more years of Zazen. You know, I mean that from the bottom of my heart. This is so wonderful. This practice is so wonderful. If you had asked me, 40 years ago, I'm not sure I would have looked forward to 40 years. Because, you know, when I first started doing meditation, getting through 25 minutes was really a challenge. You know, if somebody said 40 years, I was just trying to get through, 15 minutes. And, at the end of 25 minutes, I would sometimes be covered with sweat. And I after 25 minutes, I would just collapse, and I'd uncross my legs, and gather my wits and gather my strength for the next 25 minute sit, and hope I could make it through that. And then when I went to my first sesshin, I remember that it's challenging to sit eight hours a day, and your legs really start to hurt, and my legs, by about day three, really were sore, I remember going into the Dokusan room and just sort of crawling into the Dokusan room. So if somebody had said to me, 40 years, I would have been terrified, right? But actually, it's like that for a little while, just a little while. And then it's really just the most wonderful, in my opinion, the most wonderful thing in the world. And then you wonder, how do people make it? How do people get through life without this? It's just so wonderful. I remember reading a long time ago a book by a man named Holmes Welch. And Holmes Welch, an anthropologist who was studying Buddhist monasteries in China prior to the Cultural Revolution. And he went all over China, and he went to temples all over China, most of which were Zen temples. And he interviewed monks and nuns, and he talked to people in the community, and he wrote these two giant books that are really fascinating. I guess I'm thinking about this because Jaru just got back from 10,000 cedar mountain in China and was staying at a temple there. But Welch interviewed lots of old monks and nuns. And at one temple, there were these monks who were quite elderly. They were in their 80s. And they had been, you know, that's not as old as I used to think. Let me just put it that way. That used to seem, you know, really old. But now I'm thinking, that's not so old, you know. Anyway, he interviewed these moderately old monks who were in their 80s. And they said, and he said, you know, you guys have been doing this for probably 60 years, right? And he said, what do you think about that? And they said, we can't wait to get up in the morning to do this. They said, we actually just can't wait to get to the cushion. And they were called, by the temple, they were called the old papayas, because they were like old ripe papayas. They had been sitting in Buddha mind for 60 years, working through their obstacles, you know. And so they were very deeply awakened people. And you might think, well, what's to accomplish, right? You know, you've been doing this for 60 years. And they said, we can't wait to get to the cushion. And when he was talking with them, most of them had started doing Zazen pretty early in life. They had actually taken vows and become monks pretty early in life. And he said, well, what about people who come here and they don't like to meditate? And one of the monks, they all started laughing. They said, well, if you don't like to meditate, this is the wrong place for you. So apparently it was a self-selecting process. You know, people who liked it stayed, and these people had stayed for 60 years. But you do have to ask yourself, what are they accomplishing, or what are they doing? They've been doing this for 60 years. Probably they had their Daikensho experience long before. You know, another case in point is the Dalai Lama. You know, the Dalai Lama is so clearly a deeply awakened person. He came to our Zen center in Seattle a long time ago, like in the early 80s. He was the most lovely human being and completely unpretentious and down, just, you know, some people who are quote-unquote religious teachers, you know, try to be like, you know, try to exude an aura of mystery or like a hidden knowledge, right? So when they sort of bug their eyes out at you, or they look very serious, you know, like they have a deep secret. And the Dalai Lama wasn't like that at all. He was just totally present, unpretentious, like a lovely person. He sat, this was before he became like an international rock star, you know, he was very respected, but he hadn't reached that height of prominence yet. And he came to our Zen center, and he sat with us, and he had a meal, and just totally nice guy, you know. But at any rate, you know, the Dalai Lama has been practicing meditation probably for about 60 years also. And yet he gets up every morning, and he does meditation. In fact, the last time I checked, he was doing 4 hours of meditation every morning. And he has a very busy schedule. So he gets up around, you know, 4:30, and he has, like, some tea or something, and then he meditates, and about halfway through, according to this interview I read, he listens to half an hour of the BBC, and then he goes back and does another 2 hours of meditation, you know. So you think, what's up with that? He had his enlightenment experience long ago, the old papayas, you know. You know, it's an interesting issue. This koan is really important. Because, you know, when we think about enlightenment, you know, we have a kind of idea that it's like a goal we can set for ourselves, and we can just pursue it in a straight line. So it's like, I'm going to, I want to become an awakened being, and I'm starting at point A, and I'll just put in a lot of energy and pay a lot of attention, and I'll go from point A to point Z, and it's a straight line. But you know, actually, it's not really like that at all. You know, the truth is that to encounter enlightened consciousness, you have to do it by accident, almost. It's like you can't look at it directly. It has to come in from the side, or you have to notice it out of the corner of your eye. I hope that makes some sense. But it's not something you can aim for or shoot for and go directly toward. It's what's going to, you'll notice out of the corner of your eye as you're going towards something else. See? And lots of things in life are like that. And there's a reason in particular that this is so. You know, we like routine. We humans like routine, and then when we get everything in arranged order, we hate it, right? But we do like it. I mean, so, for example, the other day, a new semester is starting, and I went in on Monday, second Monday of the semester, and I had my comments on the first set of rough drafts all typed up, and I came into my office before my class started. I had emailed them to myself, and I opened them up, and I started printing them, and then I went out to get them, and the printer wasn't working right. So, you know, my class is like in 20 minutes, the printer isn't working right. You know, and it was like one thing after another was like that, you know. It was just like, it was a miracle that I got to class at all. It was just like one thing, as I had been going to class, as I've been driving to Rutgers, they were fixing some roads, you know. So, you know, I wound up in, I guess, in North Plainfield somewhere. My usual route takes me through South Plainfield, but the bridge that I usually go over was closed, and so I drove into North Plainfield. I had never been there. It's a fairly weird place, you know, and I was going on these little back roads, and I'm looking at my watch, and I'm trying to get to class, and then I get to class, and then the printer doesn't work, you know. So it was one of those days, right? You know, I fortunately, I had left a huge amount of time to get to work, much more than I needed. And then, so I did get to my office in time, and I was thinking, okay, I'm going to make it, and then the printer goes out, you know. So, you know, I'm so grateful for the fact that usually when I turn the key in my car, it starts, I can get to work in 25 minutes, the bridges are operating, I go in, I print my stuff off, you know, the stapler, there's staples in the stapler, you know, everything works, I get to class, and, you know, so on. So we love dependability. We love that kind of routine. And our minds love, you know, nobody likes that, you know, nobody likes driving through North Plainfield on unfamiliar roads, knowing you've got to get to class by 9:50, and you're looking at your watch, and these crazy roads are eating up all your time. Nobody likes that experience. So it's great to have predictability and dependability. But, you know, actually, that can be deadly after a while, right? You know, I was coming out of my class the other day, and I ran into a colleague of mine from the economics department. And I said, his name is Neil. And I said, hey, Neil, how's it going? And he goes, remember, this is like week three of the semester. He said something like 11 more weeks. Say, now that's enthusiasm for you, right? You know, 11. Oh, he's just scratching him off the calendar. It's like 11 more weeks. So, you know, you think, how does somebody get like that? You know, how do you get like that? Because, you know, probably when he was an undergraduate, economics was the most interesting thing he did. You know, he probably loved economics. You know, economics is a fascinating field. I wish I knew more about it. He must have had a passion for that. He went to graduate school. I know he went to a really a good graduate school for training. He came to Rutgers. You know, I actually know that he's a person who has invested huge amount of time. The reason I know him is because he's invested huge amounts of time in innovative strategies for teaching economics. He was the first professor at Rutgers to set up a computer lab so that his students could come in and model economic events and crunch data. And when I came to Rutgers, I went to his lab, which he had just set up, because I wanted to do something like that in the writing program. I wanted to set up a lab where people could do research and write online. This was all very new then. You know, computers were high tech in those days. So you know, this guy must have loved economics. He probably still does on some days. And he loves teaching. I know this because he's won awards and he has done all this innovative stuff. But you know, after 30 years, you know, he probably is counting the days till summer comes. And you think, how does that happen to somebody? And you know, the same routine that makes life controllable and dependable also kind of like kills it if we're not careful. You know? It eventually just kills it. After a while, you're just going in, you know, you go in, you're sort of just putting in, going through the motions, as we say. You go in, you bring up this point, you mention this economist, you put this formula on the board, you mention this economist, you put this formula on the board, you know, and then what do you know, it's time for lunch, right? So if you're not careful, that happens, and it happens to everybody if you're not careful, you know. When we go straight ahead, when we pursue our goal, you know, this, and when we work out these predictable routines, you know, it becomes very difficult to keep our life humming, to keep the liveliness in what we do, you know. Very hard not to teach the same material twice, you know. So every time I teach the courses I teach, I try to teach different material. And, you know, what that means is that some of it absolutely falls flat, you know. But some of it really works out. You know, things that I don't think are going to work well. There was a reading I gave to my students a few years ago, and I just thought, this is going to be too hard for them. It was their favorite reading. You know, and I'll bring in something for my students, and I'll think, they'll love this, you know, and they hate it. And when that happens, or when you give people an assignment, a new assignment, and you're thinking, oh, this is going to work well, and then you get their papers back and you think, uh-oh, what have I done? You know, that's a very uncomfortable feeling, you know. It's Saturday morning, you're grading your papers, you're thinking, okay, let me add those papers, right? You read the first paper, terrible. You read the second paper, terrible. You know, please don't quote me on that, you know, but just between you and me, not a good paper. You know, reading the next one, terrible. And then you realize it's not the students, it's my question, you know. Then you know, I feel guilty. I think, why did I do this? This was so dumb, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, in the middle of my agony, I really feel alive. I really feel alive. And it's, even though it is agony to have a bunch of papers that aren't working out and to see your students struggling, And it's agony for them too, I know. They prefer, but you know, everybody's growing in that kind of a situation. Everybody's growing. I'm growing, they're growing. You know, when they don't know what they're doing, when they're reading something that's a little bit harder than they expect, and you know, they might hate that experience, but when you get their papers, often, you know, their papers are wonderful because they're really alive. They're thinking, they're questioning, they're making connections that are unfamiliar connections. And that's, you know, that's what, if you're a teacher, that's what you live for, right? You know, so it's definitely a big problem that we crave routine and predictability, and, you know, we like, you know, basically to be able to have a system that always works. But when we get that system, you know, the strange thing is that the life kind of drains out of what we're doing. And so, you know, to keep yourself alive and lively and keep the energy in things, it's very important, you know, to mix it up, to try new things, new material, new assignments, new courses. You know, a few years ago I taught a course I had never taught before, and the whole thing was a strain, you know. It was just... It was like I just didn't know what I was doing from one end to the other. And at the end of the course, I'm not sure I would have immediately said, wow, that was great, you know. What I felt like was, I'm going to get this right next time I do it, right? But also, you know, in the middle of my discomfort, I felt so alive, so alive. And this is definitely a crucial lesson, right? You know, we need to have some order in our lives. There needs to be some predictability. But if we don't shake it up, if we don't sort of disorient ourselves, you know, it becomes dead. And there's really interesting, you know, from a Zen standpoint, that's a really interesting problem. You know, because you know, the Zen view is that reality, the Zen view is, you know, reality is beyond our powers of understanding. That's really a basic Zen view. That the real world, so-called, is vast and complex beyond human powers of understanding. And we know this in a certain way. I was just reading this physicist, and he was talking about the universe, and by the time he was done, I felt like my head was spinning, you know. He was talking about something called brains and dimensions, and by the way, he was far from a crackpot. You know, he's one of these string theorists, and he has, you know, he's won all these awards, and he has you know, he's done this mathematical work that apparently is quite impressive. And you realize, you know, when you read somebody like that, that we just see like a tiny little picture of the whole thing, right? This tiny little picture. And even he sees just a tiny little picture, as he actually sort of said at the end of his article, you know. So the Buddhist view is, you know, the real world exists, but we can't comprehend it fully. You know, we do the best we can by, you know, selecting the details that we need to work with, right? You know, so, you know, we make a world that we can live in by sort of picking and choosing from this huge bunch of information that comes flowing into our heads what we need to get by, you know. Well, we don't eat this, that's poison, eat this, you know, do this, and don't do that. You know, we come up with habits and knowledge we need to get by, to survive, and even, you know, to be happy some of the time, and so on. But a lot of things pass us by. And there's the, you know, we speak in one of the sutras we recite at Sesshin, we talk about the vastness that underlies us all. That's a basic Buddhist view. The universe is vast beyond human comprehension. So the world we humans live in is a small sampling of an infinite world. And we have taken what we need from all of this stuff so we can get by, you know, so we can live in our house or in our apartment. You know, time is infinite, but we can divide it into months and days and minutes. You know, and we can, you know, pay our rent every month. You know, the months don't really exist. They're something we invented. Rent is really just something we invented. It doesn't really exist, you know. So you know, from the Buddhist standpoint, we live in a human world, which is, you know, a reflection of human needs and desires. And we mistake it for the whole thing. We mistake it for the whole thing. You know, we're not the only creature that does this. I have a cat named Henry. And Henry is a wonderful cat. I mean, I am totally in love with Henry. Jaru has met Henry, and she knows he's an incredibly charming cat. And, you know, I'm sure his world is different from mine, right? You know, I think he believes that I'm his servant, for example, right? You know, so, you know, when he wants to go out, you know, he starts meowing, and I jump right up, and I, yes, sir, I open the door, and he looks outside. He looks out to see if he wants to go out. And if it's too cold, he turns around. It's like, no, not today. You know, okay, yes, sir, close the door. You know, if he meows again, it means I want something to eat. You know, I'll put some food on the plate. You know, and if he wants more, he can meow again. I'm his loyal servant. And I'm sure he has an image of life that's very different from mine, but it works for him, right? I mean, I will hop too whenever he asks me to do something, you know. And then if I'm nice to him or I'm a good boy, he will lavish attention on me, you know. He'll sit on my lap or something for a while, and I'm so happy, right? These humans, you know, they're so easily pleased, you know. So you know, I also remember reading, I used to have a parrot long ago. He finally passed away, but I was reading a biologist, and he was saying that animals live in their own world. Parrots live in a parrot world. You know, they don't care about, you know, traffic. You know, they don't care. The traffic doesn't exist in their world. And there was a joke in this guy's article where he said, you know, if there was a newspaper, back when the Titanic sank, it would have a headline like, "Titanic sinks. Fortunately, no parrots killed," right? So you know, we all construct the world from our own standpoint. And, you know, the problem is that we think it's real because it repeats, right? You know, so, you know, we pay the rent every month, hopefully, and we aren't evicted. And so, you know, that makes rent feel real, you know? I'm an English teacher. There's really no such thing as a teacher. It's a human invention, right? But I can feel, you know, my whole identity can be tied up in being a teacher, right? Even though it's a contrivance, right? So, you know, we create this world out of the vastness that underlies us all, this little human world. It becomes a home for us. It becomes a home for us, but, you know, it also becomes a kind of jail for us, right? When we see people at their worst, you know, at their very worst, you know, it's often because they're taking this artificial world we've created too seriously. Right. So, I don't know if you follow. I hope you don't, but you probably have been following some of that business about the memos, the dueling memos. Mm-hmm. That and I was listening to NPR the other day, and they were saying that now the two sides, the Democrats and the Republicans, They actually want to construct a wall in the hearing room so that they can't spy on each other or something like that. And you realize this is really depressing, right? These are like 11-year-olds or, you know, 8-year-olds running the country. And, of course, we have a 5-year-old at the top, right? You know, he wants, you know, toy soldiers, you know. And it's depressing, right? I mean, the idea is we have bigger fish to fry than having our soldiers march out. And, you know, it's like, come on, you know, the planet is heating up. 2017 was the hottest year on record. You know, do we really need a military parade, right? But it's a classic example of mistaking the artificial human world for reality, you know. And when people are at their worst, they take things they mistake the artificial world for the real world, you know, for the vastness that underlies us all, you know. So people can get terribly depressed over things that are so unimportant, you know, and take it so seriously, like, you know. I definitely think that people who work hard should get a raise, right? But I have actually dealt with people in the university who get a raise, but then they discover their colleague got a bigger raise, you know? And they'll say, you know, I published a book, you know, he published a book, he got, you know, 1.8%, and I got, you know, 1.2%. And this is like outrage, and they'll be all like upset for weeks. This is not really a cartoon. This really happened. This guy went on the war path. Like, you know, it's like, well, you know, I 0.6, that is a percentage. You know, that's a portion of a percent, actually. You know, I'm not sure I would. But he was in emotional turmoil over this because it was his identity. You know, and it's worth reflecting on the fact. You know, I don't say this to my colleagues, especially when they're in that state of mind. But you know, the greatest literary scholars of two generations ago, the people everybody wanted to be, nobody knows their names today. See, that's the truth. You know, so. You know, two generations ago, if you said Granville Hicks, people would have just rocked back on their heels and said, my God, do you know Granville Hicks? He's the greatest literary critic in the world, you know. Now if you say Granville Hicks, they what's that? You know, sounds like a breakfast cereal or something. So this is our fate, you know, basically. You know, we take it. We're all going to disappear from human memory. You know, Shakespeare maybe is going to be around, but you know, the greatest poets living today will be in an anthology someday that only a few people read. You know, so we take that kind of thing way too seriously, right? And there's a deeper problem. You know, the problem is that we have crossing the threshold of our consciousness, all this information, and you know, we've learned how to select certain things and ignore other things, and so, you know, we think we're encountering reality, but we're just encountering the things we are familiar with. Yeah, so the world that seems so real to us, the world of our experience, it only feels real because it's familiar. And if we're not careful, you know, we get trapped in that familiar, comfortable world, right? A friend of mine, I had known in high school, I ran into him recently, and he's a doctor, or he was a doctor. And he's actually gotten out of medicine. He just medicine lost the liveliness for him, right? And he's working like minimally as a doctor for one of these health companies, and trying to find other things in life that will bring his life back to bring the life back into his everyday existence. You know, and now I think he could have found ways to do that with medicine itself, but he's made that decision. Somehow, you know, just going into the office every day, saying, say, writing a script, you know, that lost its meaning for him because of the way he was doing it, right? You know, so one way to think about Zen is that, you know, Zen is about how to see what we can't see, right? Or how to see out of the corner of your eye, basically. You know, because, or how to find what you're not looking for, see? Zen is about how to find what you're not looking for. Because only finding what you're not looking for can actually wake us up. See, so you know, when we're looking for what we think we want, it's usually not what we really need to bring life to our existence. You know, we're usually looking for the things we're familiar with. I hope that's making sense. But, you know, we train ourselves to look for what we've already found. We train ourselves to look for what's familiar. And we call the familiar reality. And then we wonder why we're bored or unhappy or trapped. But it's just that. You know, so how do you get out of that? And you know, human beings are very bad, like, randomizers, right? You know, if I say, give me a random number, it probably won't be random. Or if I, you know, usually when we're trying to do something that's crazy, it's actually very predictable, you know, because we do work from the familiar. So you know, one way to think about Zazen, it's how to find what you're not looking for. And what you're not looking for is going to open your world up. You know, actually, koan training is just like this. You know, from the Zen standpoint, the conscious mind is very much the mind that works on predictability and familiarity. You know, fortunately, you know, we have a deeper mind, this unconscious mind, which is processing much more information than the conscious mind all the time. So you know, Zen uses the power of the unconscious mind to shake things up and to help us notice what we're not looking for and what we have, you know, help us find what we don't know we even need, right? And this is because, you know, the unconscious mind process is like the big computer, and the conscious mind is like the little computer. But the unconscious mind is taking in all this information that rarely comes to consciousness. You know, you know, when you walk into a room sometimes, you know exactly what the mood of the room is. Or you know exactly what you're expected to do, even though nobody said you're expected to do this, everybody's upset right now. You know, how do you know that? You know, you subliminally read all these signals, so you just know. You come into the room and you can say, I felt the tension. Well, nobody said we're tense. How did you feel the tension? You know, consciously there's nothing there, but unconsciously you're picking up all these signals. And this is definitely the case with many things, you know. So you know, when we do Zen training, you know, we're focusing on the conscious mind is focusing on what we think we want, what we think we need. But the unconscious mind is taking in much more information. And so you know, one way to think about Zen practice is it's learning how to see out of the corner of your eye, to see what you're not looking for. And so often in Zen practice, this is the case. I'll give somebody a koan. If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. See. So, you know, the way koans work is to activate that deeper unconscious mind. A koan is like, you could say, like a subconscious a cue, like a cue. It's triggering something in your unconscious mind. It's activating your unconscious mind. So, you know, while you're working with the koan, your conscious mind is saying, okay, let me see now. You know, a staff is something we lean on. It's something we need to walk with if we're elderly, you know. If I have a staff, I'll give you one. If you have no staff, I'll take it away. How can that happen? You know, try to reason it out. And then, you know, we're looking for something, like an answer to the koan. And the conscious mind is engaged in a search, but, you know, the unconscious mind is like beginning to be activated. So the unconscious mind is actually like the koan is like sinking down into your unconscious mind, and it's sort of like starting to percolate, and all this stuff is coming up, see, and the you know, often when people are doing their koan training, this stuff is bubbling up, but they don't want to pay attention to it. They're looking for the answer to the koan, and it's like suddenly you started thinking about your relationship with your brother, and you're angry at your brother, and you say, get out of the way, I'm trying to focus on the koan, right? And this stuff is bubbling up and bubbling up and bubbling up. And people will come in to see me in Dokusan, and I'll it's a Shin. I'll say, how's it going with your koan? They'll say, oh, nothing, nothing. And I'll say, nothing's happening? No, nothing. And then I'll say, well, tell me, you know, just tell me what's going on the cushion. You know, just tell me what's going on. They'll say, well, you know, I keep thinking about my brother, you know, and how angry I am at my brother, you know, and but that's not important. I'm trying to get to the koan. Say, so, well, actually, you know, that's the that's very important to the koan, right? See, that's not where their big mind told them to look. That's coming from, like, out of the corner of their eye. But that's where liberation is happening, see? So the processing is going on at a deeper level, and they're not finding what they're looking for. And that's why it's liberating. They're finding, you know, we're finding what we closed off from ourselves, maybe to protect ourselves, or maybe it just didn't seem useful at the time. But that's how we get out of our ruts. That's how we live a bigger life. That's how we encounter the vastness that underlies us all. We can't do it like frontally. We can't just say, I'm going to answer the koan. You know, you can try it. Feel free to try it, you know. You say, damn it, I'm, you know, pulling up my legs. I'm not going to move. I'm going to go staff, 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 staff. You know, staff, give, take, give, take. It's actually, you should say give, take, give, take, give, take, give, take. You know, and, you know, you can get really upset about it. But actually what has to happen is it's kind of an oblique process, you know. You just have to be patient and let the unconscious mind help you. You have to sort of get out of your own way. And that's difficult. You know, because we like predictability and control, it's hard to let it go and just trust. You know, and let things wander. You know, it can make you nervous, you know, to be out of control, to be going through this process. It's like, this is making me very nervous. You know, I'm not in charge here. It's like, isn't that wonderful? You know, isn't that wonderful? You know, so you can't make things happen, right? You know, you just have to be open to the process. You have to be open to the process and let the big mind produce your liberation for you, right? You know, and this can be a real challenge for certain kinds of temperaments. You know, people like to be in control. And you can't make it happen. You know, I remember when I had been training with Genki Roshi for a couple years, maybe 3 years, I was his attendant, and he was talking to somebody else, and he was like another Zen Roshi, and he said, "Yeah, I remember when that was Yamamoto Genpo's session. I answered like 12 koans, you know." And I had not answered any koans, right? It was like, or it took me like a year, 2 years to answer a koan. And I just thought, oh my God, you know, he answered 12 in one session, and I can't answer one in 2 years, right? So, you know, I decided I've got to buckle down, right? Which was a disaster, right? You know, at some point you just give up. You say, I'm going to show up. I'm going to get on the cushion. I'm coming to session. But, you know, I'm not going to come to session saying, damn it, this time I'm answering my koan. That's like jinxing yourself, right? You have to just let the big mind do its work. And it's going to tell you what you don't know, right? And only the big mind can tell you what you don't know. Your little mind, your conscious mind, your personal self mind can't do that. You know, it's too invested in predictability. So, you know, this business of Zen practice is infinitely liberating. Because, you know, you're constantly encountering what you haven't discovered yet. You know, and that process is actually, at first, you know, it is a little nerve-wracking, right? You know, it took me a while to just be able to sit physically. It wasn't easy for me to sit physically and drop my body, you know, just to be totally in deep samadhi. Very difficult. But you know, I got the hang of it. And, you know, when I first started doing sesshins, you know, and when I first started doing koan training, it was very difficult. You know, I wanted to solve the problem. You know, I wanted to resolve the issue. And just letting things slide, it felt like, you know, having no time, it made me anxious, you know. I had always gotten good grades in school. I wanted good grades in Zen. And instead I was getting indefinite number of incompletes, you know. But actually, the life of Zen is living with your incompletes, right? You know, the big mind is going to finish the paper, basically. You know, the big mind is going to take the test. So you just have to be the servant of your big mind. You know, you just have to sit down on the cushion, you know, straighten the back, watch the breath, enter mushin, and then work with your koan. And you aren't the master. And that's what's so wonderful and liberating. And again, you know, doors open up that you never thought existed. And your life just is like infinitely rich and open. You know, it is. It's just great. It's, you know, those old papayas knew what I'm talking about, right? You know, they got up every, they said, we can't wait to do, and by the way, you know what they called meditation? They called it their work. They said, we can't wait to do our work, see? I love that. Because, you know, a lot of Western people think of meditation as just sitting down on the cushion and entering a serene and blissful place. But that actually is predictability again, right? That's not making your world bigger. That's just retreating into one experience of the world, sereneness and calm, which is nice, but it's not enlightenment. See? So the old papayas understood, you know, you have to do the work. And the work is, you know, engaging with your koan and then waiting for the big mind to answer. And it's a challenge. If you don't try, nothing happens. So you've got to make an effort. But then you have to let go. Uwe. This is like, could be translated as uwe. Effortless effort. You know, effortless effort. Try, but don't, but then let go. Right? Try, but let go. If you don't try, nothing happens. But if you don't let go, you stay in your own prison of familiarity. The clear ground where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles deludes people. Predictability. See? The clear ground where there's not an inch of grass deludes people. See? The clear sky without a fleck of cloud in the eight directions fools you. You think you know it all, right? Even though this is using a wedge to remove a wedge, it doesn't prevent taking space and hanging it in space. A single mallet on the back of the brain. It's like sometimes we need to be hit in the back of the head with a mallet, hopefully only in a figurative way. But we need to get out of our ruts. Great Master Wan Ming of Deshan said to the assembly, when you get to the ultimate end, you find the Buddhas of all times have had their mouths hung on the wall. There is still someone who laughs, ha ha. If you know this one, your task of study is finished. In other words, it's never finished. That's what makes it alive. Verse, gathering in, holding closed the throat, the wind polishes clouds white. The waters are chill, the weather is autumn. Don't say brocade-colored fish lack rich taste. Fishing through the ocean waves, one hook of moon. we throw a line into the water, we don't expect to pull up the moon, but sometimes we do.